At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
The letters F and B, you put them in the right order, you got one story today. Also, corn and hogs. Yes, it is one of those days. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today, the 26th day of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody, here with the number of the day this Thursday. It's not exactly an economic indicator, but it does offer perhaps a hint of some of the changes coming in this economy. Changes in the way that we relate to our technology and the way technology relates to, you know, people. The number is 18.96. It's measured in percent, and it's the drop that Facebook shares took today after an oh-so-disappointing earnings call after the bell yesterday. Investors were caught off guard, to say the very least, by how big a deal the Cambridge Analytica data sharing scandal has turned out to be among Facebook users and how much it might cost the company to regain that trust. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer gets us going.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg was blunt in yesterday's earnings call.
We're investing so much in security that it will significantly impact our profitability. We're starting to see that this quarter.
Facebook says it's spending more than $1 billion a year to improve security and how it handles private data. BTIG analyst Richard Greenfield says the money will be used
to verify content that's posted, to make sure that advertisers are who they say they are and where those ads are coming from.
There was a backlash from Facebook users after they learned that Cambridge Analytica got a hold of their private data to sell to political campaigns. But users aren't abandoning Facebook en masse. It's just too big a part of their lives. Michael Preem is a digital ad consultant. He says, we use Facebook for more than just staying in touch with our friends.
To log in and to actually interact with either making other purchases or to verify our identity.
So Facebook probably won't be doing a face plant. But internet security and data privacy, those are sticky problems. If you're a drug maker facing trust issues, you can just change your packaging to make your medications more secure. Raymond James Managing Director Aaron Kessler says Facebook's fixes aren't so easy.
There's bad actors that try to stay one step ahead of you in terms of safety and security issues as well. It's kind of a game back and forth.
A very expensive game that never ends. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We are getting an actual economic indicator tomorrow, gross domestic product growth for the April to June quarter. Best guesses are that it's going to be pretty good, somewhere above 4%, maybe even touching 5%. That's as compared to first quarter growth of 2%. And as I said, that's a pretty nice jump, but, well, just but. Here's Marketplace's Kimberly Adams.
The economy has been growing steadily over the past decade, but during the second quarter of this year, there were some drastic changes that sped up growth. Maya McGinnis is president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
First through big tax cuts, then through big spending increases. And there are also some changes, things to do with trade, that may bump up those numbers even further.
In particular, tariffs and concerns about them may have changed business behavior in the last few months. Erica Groshen, a senior scholar at Cornell and former head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, says those changes will likely show up in the GDP numbers, but not over the long term.
You might see a stockpiling of goods where people might think that the price was going up sometime soon.
What will also show up is the result of the tax cuts. Some corporations increased spending. Seth Carpenter is chief U.S. economist for UBS.
The boost to the economy from the tax cuts is going to be real. It's going to be measurable. However, it's also going to be temporary and start to peter out after next year.
Carpenter says it's never a good idea to base a long-term view of the economy on one quarter's GDP. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, hey, quick, could somebody remind me which of the major indices includes Facebook and which one doesn't? Because that's kind of a hint as to how things went. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Trump's been in the Midwest this afternoon celebrating the expansion of a steel plant in Illinois. He was in Iowa this morning celebrating the agreement to start talking about reaching a trade deal with the European Union that he announced yesterday. We've got a couple of farmers we check in with from time to time when news like this comes up. Keith Alverson grows corn and soybeans in South Dakota. Brian Duncan does hogs and soybeans in Illinois. I threw Keith the first question when we talked, which basically boiled down to how he's feeling about the president's announcement.
You know, it's a positive step. Still, you know, the European Union soybean market's about seven times smaller than that of China. And so the bigger thing is the negotiations with China in regards to that. And so while it's a positive step and a movement in the right direction, the eye is still on the prize for the U.S. farmer.
Brian Duncan, same question to you.
Yeah, I'd echo what Keith says, but I think also if we can forge alliances with Europe, Mexico, with Canada, and then turn as one to face China, I think that's also a benefit to us as we seek to resolve these differences on trade.
Yeah, but Brian, lay me the odds, right? Because up until yesterday, nobody had even blinked in this thing. And so far, we have nothing from the Chinese, which is a huge market for American hogs. It's a huge market for American soybeans. Brian, nobody seems to be backing down in that relationship.
And that's obviously of concern. But that being said, I guess we in the country have to sit out here and hope there's things going on behind the scenes and continue to urge the administration to get to the table and get to work to resolve these issues.
Keith Alverson, what's your level of hope, man? What's your level of optimism?
Boy, you know, we real similar situation. Things aren't looking too optimistic right now. We were promised bilateral trade deals, and we're hoping some of those come to fruition. And so, you know, it's tough to see the light at the end of the tunnel at this point.
So the light at the end of the tunnel could be, for both of you, a slice of the $12 billion in aid that the Trump administration the other day promised it was going to grant. Brian, the Secretary of Agriculture or the Secretary of Commerce, I'm not sure actually who has the physical money, they come to you and say, here is part of $12 billion. Is that going to do it for you?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that we're grateful for the acknowledgement of the economic damage that's been done. But sadly, $12 billion is going to fall short. And yes, that money will help meet some short-term needs. But I think, as Keith says, we've got to talk about the longer-term prize, too, because I'm afraid the damage could mount quickly into hundreds of billions of dollars. You know, and so there's not a Band-Aid for that injury.
Keith, what's the sense of what it would take to, you know, with soybean prices where they are and corn and all that, what would your slice of this $12 billion make you whole, I guess, is the question?
No, really unlikely. We're looking at, just with the market drop that we've seen, you know, in this production year, somewhere around $50 to $100 an acre in lost revenue potential. You know, a lot of times that's easily the profit margin that farmers have figured in at the beginning of the year. And so, you know, we're back to break-even prices or below break-even in some circumstances. And so, you know, we want more markets, not less, and, you know, rather have trade than aid.
Acknowledging that farmers are subject to a whole lot of variables, right, from weather to market prices to take your pick, how big a blip is this for you, Brian Duncan, in your economic future?
It could dramatically change the look of rural America, Kai. I mean, this we've seen the six big commodities drop in value on an annualized basis, $20 billion. since the trade war began. That's $20 billion with a B in a year that we were forecast in agriculture to have a net income of $60 billion. So you see what that means. And so if this continues on, this is not just potentially damaging to my own personal economy, but to the economy of rural America.
Brian Duncan grows hogs, and I guess, what do? You raise hogs, I suppose, and you grow soybeans in Illinois. And Keith Alverson, our corn and soybean farmer in South Dakota. Thanks, you two. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Guy.
There was an economic report out from the White House last month that went the way of a lot of government economic reports, which is to say mostly unnoticed, except for this one particular bit. It was a report on, and here's the title, Expanding Work Requirements in Non-Cash Welfare Programs. And here's the bit that got some attention. Quote, based on historical standards of material well-being, the report said, our war on poverty is largely over and a success. It got attention, that bit did, because it's part of the way the Trump administration and Republicans in Congress are making the case for imposing work requirements on people who get government assistance for food and housing. We spent a lot of time the past 18 months or so this program has in a place that would be hard hit by some of those changes, the city of Erie, Pennsylvania. Marketplace's Erica Barris went back a couple of weeks ago.
It's late morning in downtown Erie, and men, women, and children are already lined up at the Erie City Mission because lunch is about to begin.
You don't like cucumbers, Ronnie, huh?
I don't have tea.
Oh, okay.
Green beans?
Yes, please.
That's 66-year-old Roberta Lubman making her way through the line. Lubman is on disability and receives about $200 a month in government food assistance from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, what we think of as food stamps.
I only buy simple stuff, you know, ramen noodles, and I hardly eat any meat, but I make my meals last. I cut them in two.
Even so, they don't last long enough. And about a third of the way into the month, Lubman starts having lunch at the mission to fill in the gaps.
It's not easy to get by.
The war on poverty has not been won in Erie City. Around a quarter of residents still live under the federal poverty line, nearly twice the national average. And they rely on government-subsidized housing, food, and health care to get by. But in some neighborhoods, two out of three people are poor. Lubman lives in one of those neighborhoods. So does Chanae Williams.
This is why we're living in these homes, because we need the help.
Williams is 25. She grew up in Harbor Homes public housing and lives there now with her daughter Sierra and Amaria, who is just 8 months old. Before Amaria, Williams worked two jobs as a nurse assistant and a hairstylist, making around $10 an hour. But the money never went far enough.
Well, what cash do I have to, you know what I mean? Because I still have to pay my rent and I still have to buy certain things that I need for my children. They need clothes, they need shoes, they need.
Because she's not working and has a baby, Williams' family gets the maximum SNAP benefit, about $500 a month. And because Amaria is still mainly nursing, and because Williams inherited her mom's deep freezer, Williams can buy extra food in bulk and freeze it. She also has other ways of making the food last longer, especially in the summer when her daughter doesn't get lunch at school.
I don't eat sometimes. I eat enough that is I need to breastfeed, but there's days where I'll just opt for something instead of a full meal.
The Trump administration wants to impose steeper work requirements on people like Williams. Estimates are the new requirements could cut as many as 1 million people from the SNAP program over the next decade. Cuts will be coming to the other safety net programs, too.
When they want more from us, we have to figure out where are we going to get it from.
For Williams, who is looking for work now, that may mean finding more hours.
I'm just at loss as to how am I going to get that option? How am I going to open up to me? What is going to open up to me?
Sabrina Tolbert is a social worker who grew up here on Erie's east side and still lives here. Tolbert spends her days helping people like Chanae Williams gain financial independence.
A lot of people are depressed because they think they're never going to get out of their situation. They're working two part-time jobs. They're just worried about living day to day. There's no looking at the future.
The proposed legislation that would cut SNAP also calls for funding to expand state employment and training programs. But Tolbert says that wouldn't matter. The jobs just aren't here.
You're lucky if you can find a job, you know, and that, again, that would be working at McDonald's or somewhere like that.
She says about half the people she grew up with left Erie long ago for cities with better job markets. Now Erie is so poor and has so much need, the ones still here mostly work in social services.
If you have a degree or something, you can get into jobs like that. So that might be kind of all that's left for us.
As we wrap up our conversation at a community center, Tolbert gets ready to head home and to her second job. Even though she's one of Erie's lucky ones with full-time work, at night she does transcribing. That extra $100 a week, she says, really helps. In Erie, I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The way that I can connect with people emotionally is to dig into something really personal.
So we dig deep with Marty Noxon, but first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. The Dow Industrial's up 112 on this Thursday, 0.4%, closed at 25,527. The NASDAQ dropped 80 points, 1%, 78.52. The S&P 500 down 8 points, 0.3%, 28.37. So now, do you know which major index? Major indices, rather, Facebook is in, yes, the NASDAQ, the S&P. Largest dollar amount lost ever by an American company. By the by. Staying in tech, Facebook's woes did not cast a pall over advanced micro devices. Chipmakers surged 14% after reporting better than expected sales and earnings on Wednesday. Qualcomm up 7% today after ending its pursuit of China's NXP semiconductors. NXP down 5%. Scott Tong gave you that story yesterday. The qualitative ways China can mess with us tariff-wise. Bonds down. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.98%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hi, I'm Zach, and I listen to Marketplace in Arlington, Virginia. I think what I appreciate the most about Marketplace is their ability to take the economic news of the day, issues such as tariffs, rate hikes, and tax reform, cut through the political noise, and clearly and concisely explain not only how these issues affect our country and the rest of the world, but how they impact people like me. I hope you'll consider joining me as a Marketplace investor and donate today at marketplace.org to help make their work possible.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Sergio Marchionne died yesterday, as you might have heard. The former CEO of Fiat Chrysler was 66 years old and has rightly been remembered as a legend in the global automobile industry. He's credited with turning around both Fiat in the mid-2000s and then Chrysler. But it's worth taking a minute here to remember where Chrysler was when Marchionne took over and where it might be headed now. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
First, there was this from President George W. Bush in 2008.
And that is why my administration worked with Congress on a bill to provide automakers with loans to stave off bankruptcy.
Most agreed that Ford and GM were too big to let fail, so bailing them out had to happen. Chrysler?
Chrysler has always been the most marginal of the Detroit automakers.
Ed Niedermeyer covers the automotive industry. He says industry experts talked about letting the brand die off. That way Ford and GM would have more market access, and the automotive industry could be more streamlined. Then this happened in 2009 with President Obama.
Today, I am pleased to announce that Chrysler and Fiat have formed a partnership that has a strong chance of success.
Niedermeyer says Fiat was really the only company willing to rescue the Chrysler brand, and the partnership made a lot of sense.
Sergio Marchionne, who is a very unique, singular figure in the automotive landscape, had rescued Fiat. Fiat had been sort of the Chrysler of Europe.
Before getting into cars, Marchionne was a banker and understood how to turn businesses around. Dave Sullivan, an analyst at Auto Pacific based in Michigan, says the CEO had a vision for Chrysler.
Marchionne came in and said that, you know, their small cars would pair up well with Ram pickups and Jeeps, and that, you know, would be a match made in heaven.
Marchionne saw the company's value increase more than tenfold. He was due to retire next year, so there was already a succession plan in place. The board named Mike Manley as the new CEO. He built his reputation heading up Jeep, which is one of the only divisions at Chrysler making any money. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
So Summer has traditionally been kind of a dead zone in the television calendar. The big networks mostly save their big premieres for the fall, but increasingly, and especially this summer, with streaming services and cable networks pumping out more and more of their own original content, there's a whole lot to watch out there. You might have heard about a new show on HBO called Sharp Objects or Dietland on AMC, or maybe your summer watch list included the final season of Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce on Bravo. Three different shows, all created and run by the same woman who's been in television since her days working on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Marti Noxon is her name. It's so good to have you on.
Why, thank you.
So you are running three shows on three different networks, right? So my first question is, do you actually have time to be sitting here doing this interview?
I mean, that's what's interesting is a lot of people think that you do it all yourself. But the truth is, you know, one of the ways that I really believe a show gets great is by letting people do their jobs, by learning to let go of certain things and be like, you're great at that. You don't have to ask me every question. Like, you can answer your own question. How about that?
How hard was it for you to let go?
It depends on the show. Like,
that's so funny.
A little bit, or maybe it depends on what phase the show is in. When we're first creating it and sort of setting the template for how it looks and how it feels, I'm very hands-on. And but there's a lot of ways to communicate that. You know, for Dietland, we created a lookbook, and I created like a visual map of how different parts of the show should look. And then other people could share that information. Like, this is the color palette here. This is, you know, so, but it, yeah, I'm pretty controlling at the beginning.
I was just going to say, well, I was with you until you got the color palette, and I'm like, oh man, wait, what?
No, I mean, it's very intentional. It's very intentional, every part of it. I mean, because television is so much more like film now.
Yeah.
You know, the level of quality that you want to try to achieve and the visual quality, unless you're just communicating like a crazy person, it can drift.
You know, you mentioned television and film, and I didn't want to ask the peak TV question, but they're right, because everybody asks that. Every TV person I get in here, I ask a peak TV question, and then it inevitably gets cut in the edit. Right. So I'm not going to ask it, but I'm going to ask a version of it, which is TV now is, and this is not my original idea, it's the American art form now.
Right.
It's the American visual art form.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I made a film called To the Bone, which, you know, we took to Netflix, and it was the first thing I've directed in a long time. And it's a movie, you know, but the major player that stepped forward was Netflix. And it was so interesting because everybody else sort of dropped away because they knew they couldn't match that deal. You know, Netflix put $8 million on the table for a film that cost around three. And by the way, at that point, I don't have a choice. Like, I've given the choice of where it goes over to the producers
who found
the money. So they just sort of said, we're going with Netflix, even though part of me was like, but I want it to be a movie. You know, I want it to be a movie in theaters. It is weird that the business model is just changing it. So even if you very intentionally make a film, it's going to end up being on TV.
So we're getting far afield from my notes and the stuff I want to talk to you about. But I think this is really interesting because, I mean, do you look now at the dollar figures being thrown around?
Yeah.
Content dollar figures with Netflix and HBO and Amazon. And do you just go, holy cow, this is amazing?
Well, you know, I think I've come to a much broader understanding of the business. And the truth is, when you think about, like, let's look at the finances for something like Sharp Objects, which, you know, was a movie budget, but they got 8 hours of content. The more I started to understand that, the more I started realizing, like, a lot of this money that they end up paying to the writers or the actors is insignificant to them, based on the content that plays internationally for years and years and years.
So let me pull back out of that rabbit hole then and get to some of the stuff I want to talk about on the list, which is the content of the stuff that is on your show, specifically now Dietland and Sharp Objects.
Yeah.
It's not autobiographical, right? But there's a lot of you in here. You draw on you in the themes and the emotional impact of a lot of what's in here.
Yeah.
Is that easy? Why? First of all, why?
Why? You know, let's get my shrink on the phone. I'm working on a film right now, a story about a woman who, you know, she lost her son in a Stand Your Ground shooting. And people keep asking me, like, that's not funny. Like, why do you keep going to these stories? But the truth is, the way that I can connect with people emotionally is to dig into something really personal and try to reveal something about my own life experience or fears or concerns that other people will suddenly feel less alone. The people who found Dietland, I get these text messages that are like, this is life. Like, this is keeping me feeling like I'm not alone.
Marty Noxon, it's a couple of shows, Sharp Objects and Dietland, also Girlfriend's Guide. Thanks for coming in. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
If you've seen any of Marty Noxon's shows, you know there's a whole lot of character stuff to talk about, which we did, women and how they are shown on TV today. We've got this whole interview online at our website, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which context once again and always is everything, getting us back to where we started, Facebook and how it's going to have to work to get back from where it is user trust wise. Look, it's a real problem for the company and it is going to be expensive. And yes, we led today with its drop in its stock price and Mark Zuckerberg lost $16 billion in his net worth. Yes, but at the close today in New York, you could buy one share of Facebook for what you'd have had to pay for one share of Facebook all the way back in May. So May was like 2 months ago, in case I wasn't clear, right? Okay. Dow Industrial's up 112 today, 0.4%. NASDAQ down 80 points, about 1% there. S&P 500 off 8.3%. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Stephen Gregory, John Gordon, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Debke. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.